The series, the name of the series is quite simply Wilderness. It's a really popular theme all throughout Scripture. It's a really strong metaphor in Scripture that is particularly applicable to the days that lead up to the most sacred days in the Christian calendar, the days when we commemorate Jesus' death and Jesus' resurrection, the Good Friday and the Easter. We call that the Passion Narrative or the Holy Week. We call it, it's the most sacred time in the Christian calendar. It's the reason that we gather in this place. It's the reason that Christians have been gathering for more than 2,000 years because of what happened that week. And so this period that leads up to that, we call Lent. And it's 40 days plus Sundays. It began last Wednesday on what was called Ash Wednesday, and it goes on right up until Easter. And it's intended to parallel the 40 days and nights that Jesus spent in the wilderness. So as Alan just read us, there's this story where it happens right after Jesus had been baptized. So the launching, essentially, of Jesus launching into the ministry that would lead to his crucifixion and his death was his baptism in the desert. His cousin baptized him. And then he was driven out into the wilderness where the devil met him in his weakness and his vulnerability with major temptations, which then Jesus rebutted at every turn. And then he went back and he started up with the ministry that God had called him to. So this theme of wilderness is the place where Jesus was when all of that happened. It's throughout Scripture, though. It's a wild place. It's an untamed place. It's often uninhabited and a lonely place, a place of isolation. It's barren. It's uncultivated. It's a place in Scripture of two things. It's a place of safety and refuge on the one hand, where you go to escape danger. It's also a place of danger itself, where sometimes you are driven involuntarily. So it can be both things, and many of the stories in Scripture that incorporate the wilderness theme have both of those in them. It's where a person encounters the devil. It's also where a person encounters God. So in that story that Alan just read for us of Jesus, he goes out there, he's tempted by the devil in the wilderness, but also God's angels come and minister to him at the end of the temptation. Two stories that I wanted to tell you about, which you may or may not be familiar with, from the Old Testament, which is where all of it is really rooted. The first is the story of a woman named Hagar and her son Ishmael. Abraham, the father of the faith. Abraham is the guy who was going about his own business when God said to him, "I want you to pack up your family and move to a place that I'm going to show you." Abraham is the first guy that God made his promises to. You're going to have descendants as numerous as the grains of sand along the beach. You are going to be the nation, the father of this nation that I am going to create, which is going to be dedicated to me, through whom all the nations of the world will know who I am, will know that I am good. You're going to be a light to all of the other nations. That's Abraham. Abraham was married to a woman named Sarah, and together they had a slave. They had a bunch of slaves because Old Testament, we won't get into the topic of slavery today. They had a slave, and her name was Hagar. Years went on. Years and years and years went on. And God's promise of descendants, which meant starting with at least one child for Abraham and Sarah, didn't happen, and didn't happen, and didn't happen. And finally, Sarah and Abraham sit down and they go, God is not holding up his end of this. So how about this? We have the solution. And Sarah says to Abraham, why don't you sleep with Hagar? And then our descendants can happen that way. We'll just kind of adopt that child as our own. And so that happens. And it doesn't go very well. Here's what happens. You won't be surprised. Hagar gets pregnant. Hagar has a child. She starts to look down on Sarah, or at least that's how Sarah interprets it, because she has a child, Sarah doesn't. And all your worth as women is bound up in whether or not you can have children. So Sarah gets really angry, and Sarah starts to become really, really abusive to this slave, until eventually Hagar can't take it anymore. And she packs up her child, and she races off, where? Into the wilderness, into a place where she will be safe from Sarah, where she will be safe from Abraham, where she can protect her child from the abuses and the oppression of her masters. And while she is there hiding in the wilderness, God's angels come and minister to her. And God says, okay, you need to go back. And so she does. He doesn't tell her why, but she goes back. Ishmael grows up. Ishmael is 14 when Sarah finally gives birth to Isaac. Over the next little bit of time, things are really bad again, because now Sarah has a child, so she doesn't really need Hagar. She doesn't need Ishmael to take the place of eldest son, the most privileged position in the family. Things are pretty bad. By the time Ishmael is maybe, he's in his teenage years, maybe 16, 17 years old, Abraham and Sarah say, get out. You can't stay here anymore. It's gone very, very bad. And so Hagar and Ishmael are sent out into the wilderness, not running away for safety this time, sent out. Abraham gives them a little bit of food, a skin of water that doesn't last very long. And there's Hagar watching her son lie unto a single tree out there, dying, she herself dying, when God appears and God, it says, opens her eyes so that she saw a well. God provides for them in the desert, in the wilderness, ministers to them. And we know later that Ishmael himself becomes the father of a nation. And what's really neat, what I love, is that it doesn't just end there. But when you get to Genesis 25, at the end, when Abraham has died, Sarah has already died, Abraham has died, we just hear of Ishmael once more in the Old Testament. And what we hear is that somehow Ishmael came back and he and Isaac together buried their father. And I love that, because it's like whatever happened with their parents, whatever was going on with that, it seems like there was this reconciliation. It seems like there was this friendship between these two men, Isaac and Ishmael. Moses is another character who goes into the wilderness. This is a story you might be a little bit more familiar with. Moses was a Jewish man, an Israelite. They weren't really called Jews yet. An Israelite. He was part of a nation of slaves who were all enslaved by Egypt. He, through a series of miraculous events, ends up being raised in the Pharaoh's castle. The Pharaoh's daughter ends up becoming his kind of surrogate mom. But he's aware that he's got these two parts within him. One day when he's a man, he's out and he sees one of the slave masters beating one of the Israelite slaves. And Moses just is incensed. He kills the slave master. He knows he's going to be punished for murder. So he goes fleeing. Where does he flee? Into the wilderness. He runs away to this place of refuge. And he's there a long, long time. And he's there. He meets his wife there. And he builds up some riches there in the place of herds and flocks of sheep and goats out there. And then one day, he's in the wilderness, and he sees this bush that's on fire that isn't burning up, and God's voice comes out of it. And what does God do? He sends him back. Just like God sent Hagar and Ishmael back when she had fled into the wilderness for refuge, so he sends Moses back. And he says, you need to go back, and you need to talk to the Pharaoh, and you need to get him to let my people go. There's another story of a prophet named Elijah many, many years later. Elijah has this incredible experience. He's one of the only prophets of God who's left, and he's feeling very alone. And there's an evil, evil king and queen who are on the throne, Ahab and Jezebel, and they have all these prophets to their false god of Baal. And one day there's this, like a duel, it's like a prophet's duel, and it's they're testing to see which god is real. And so the prophets of Baal, they set up their altar, and Elijah sends up his altar, and Elijah says to them, I bet you that whatever you do, your God will not answer your prayers to light your altar on fire. And he says, but my God will. And so for days, the prophets of Baal, they dance around their fire. They make sacrifices. They do everything they can to convince God. And Elijah's kind of a jerk through it all. Elijah's like, I don't know, maybe your God's sleeping. You should call louder. Maybe he's busy somewhere else. You should really do something else. And he's mocking them the whole time. And of course, nothing happens because theirs is a false God. And then Elijah's turn comes, and he says, I'm going to show you just how real my God is. Bring me buckets and buckets of water. And so they bring buckets and buckets of water, and Elijah dumps them all over his altar, going, you thought it was going to be impressive before. Now wait till you see. And then he just says, okay, God, show them. And God lights the altar on fire. It's this incredible sacrifice. And then there's a whole lot of murder and mayhem and death that happens. And Jezebel is really mad. And Jezebel is out for Elijah's blood. She wants him gone. And you would think Elijah's pumped, right? He's seen this incredible miracle of God. You would expect him to step up and go, nothing can hurt me. I can take on Jezebel. I can take on Ahab. Because God, my God, is the living God. Look what he did. That's not what happens. He's exhausted. He's drained. He runs where? To the wilderness. He runs, I picture him curling up in the fetal position. He's exhausted. He's afraid. He knows that Jezebel wants him dead. He knows that she has all the power. He goes to the wilderness, and that's where an angel of the Lord meets him, feeds him, gives him rest before sending him back into the fray. It's this repeated story that happens over and over and over again. The wilderness is this place of refuge, this place where you go, where God meets you, but it's also a place of danger. The second time that Hagar was in the wilderness with Ishmael, they almost died because the wilderness is a dangerous place. The second time Moses was in the wilderness, he was there with the people of Israel. They'd escaped from Egypt. They were free finally, until all of a sudden you've got Pharaoh's army regretting the decision they'd made, coming, pounding down on them in their chariots and their war horses, and they're forced to flee across the Red Sea into the barren, barren wilderness, where they have no abilities to survive, where they are completely and solely and totally dependent on God because it is a barren, uncultivated, isolated land. Wilderness in Scripture is a place of refuge and it's a place of danger. Also a place where people meet God. There's a parallel to Jesus' 40 days in the wilderness, to Israel who was 40 years in the wilderness. Israel went into the wilderness kind of voluntarily, perhaps even triumphantly. They'd escaped their oppressors. But once they were there, the inhospitable and dangerous reality led to doubt and attempts to reassert control. It led to despair. Jesus went into the wilderness following the dramatic events of his baptism. Scripture tells us that the Spirit of God drove him into the wilderness, which to me suggests it wasn't totally voluntary. For 40 days and 40 nights, he's without any food. He's weak. He's vulnerable. And that's when the devil shows up. Because let's be honest, that's always when the devil shows up. Not when we're feeling strong and we're on fire. The devil shows up when we're weak, when we're tired, when we're exhausted, when we're hungry. But unlike Israel, who went, okay, we're going to take control of things ourselves, Jesus said, no, it's still going to be God's way. And he spoke back to the devil. Each of those temptations that came along, Jesus put up, it was like he put up his hand and he said, no, as weak and as vulnerable as I am, I'm not going to give in to this. Wilderness experiences don't always have to be a time of trial and pain. They might be a time of oasis from abuse or oppression or hurt or pain. In Scripture, wilderness experiences are usually times of transformation. They usually result from the quiet and the solitude of the wilderness where there's finally room for God to speak and God to move. There's this one commentator who had this to say about Jesus' experience in the wilderness. He wrote, Jesus' ministry begins in the wilderness. Immediately after being baptized, claimed as God's own beloved child, Jesus is led by the Spirit into the wilderness in order to be tempted. It is tempting for us to stay in the glow of baptism and move immediately into Christ's ministry, but the movement of the Spirit in this text is clear. Jesus must go to the wilderness. He must experience hunger, fear, scarcity, and loneliness. He must be brought to the point where the offers of the devil become more and more and more enticing. There's something for Jesus to experience in the wilderness. I don't think the wilderness is a place most of us choose to go voluntarily, especially when everything in life is great. Things have to be really, really bad usually for us to run there for refuge. Hagar ran from abusive owners. Moses ran from a murder charge. Elijah ran from a vindictive, bloodthirsty queen. I was wondering what that looks like in our lives. What is the wilderness that we run to for refuge when our life is really hard? And as I was thinking about that question, I was struck by the fact that rarely do we run to the kind of refuge, the kind of wilderness where God meets us. More often, we run to a place where we can hide from our weakness, where we can hide from our vulnerability, where we can pretend that the pain and the suffering isn't there. And so we use drugs or alcohol or television or anything else that we can think of to numb us to what's going on. We go to sleep for hours on end. My friend and I this week were talking about how both of us share when stress gets really, really heavy. Some people, it keeps them awake. My friend and I share this trait that when stress gets really heavy, we just curl up in bed and we can sleep for days, which isn't helpful, by the way. Some of us escape into overwork and busyness. We just keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going, so that we don't actually have to face the things that are hard, face the things that are hurting us, face the things that are painful. The wilderness is anything we do or any place we go that we don't have to deal with the truth and deal with reality. I think too often that's what the wilderness becomes for us. That's the wilderness we voluntarily enter. Sometimes the wilderness is a place that we're sent. Hagar was sent away by her jealous mistress. Moses and Israel were forced to the wilderness by Pharaoh's army. Jesus was driven to the wilderness by the Spirit. This is when we find ourselves suffering, the kind of suffering over which we have very little control. This wilderness is the place of death and sickness. It's the place of unemployment and homelessness. It's the place of violence and neglect. It's the place that's untamed and isolated and barren. It's the place where we escape or hide from relationship. It's the place of weakness and vulnerability. It's the place of temptation. It's the place where the whispers of the devil seem to have more sway. It's the place where we're more likely to succumb to temptation. It's the place where God perhaps seems very far away or even totally absent. But if there's one consistency in every scriptural account of wilderness, it's this: despite what it feels like, despite how blind or deaf we may be to God's Spirit when we're in the wilderness, God is present nevertheless. The wilderness is the place where God does extraordinary work in his people. Hagar and Ishmael were saved, but they weren't just saved. Ishmael became the father of a nation, just like Isaac. Israel became a nation. They were this motley crew of slaves who was formed into a nation in the 40 years that they wandered in the wilderness. Jesus became the Messiah. I think that up until Jesus was confronted with the devil and those temptations that faced him said, listen, feed yourself. You don't need to depend on God to provide your food. Listen, step up and feed everybody else. Deal with the issue of suffering and poverty and all that. Do it in your own power. You don't need to do it God's way. Every time Jesus said, no, I am committed to God's way, it was like he was more and more stepping into that person of the Messiah. And he was saying, I am the Son of God, the Messiah who will save the world. And he made that choice in the wilderness when he was at his weakest, when he was vulnerable to those temptations. It wasn't the only time Jesus spent in the wilderness. Over and over again, as we read in his life, we're told that he withdrew from the crowds, the need, and even his disciples. He withdrew to the wilderness to pray. He withdrew to the wilderness voluntarily to be with his Father. That's because he knew that if he was going to live and die as God wanted, he had to spend time with God. And he knew he was more likely to encounter God and be able to be filled up and reminded of who God is in the wilderness, that place of isolation and barrenness and desolation, when surrounded by the busyness and the noise of life day to day. He knew that as frightening and as dangerous as the wilderness is, it's also the place of weakness in which God is waiting to feed us and to strengthen us, to form us into people who are holy, to form us into people through whom others will know the extraordinary love of God. Lent, this time of year in the Christian calendar, is a time set apart. It's a time set apart for Jesus' disciples to follow him into the wilderness. It's a time to voluntarily be stripped of the comforts and the distractions that are so much part of our daily lives. It's a time to rid ourselves of those things that have become buffers between us and God. It's a time for encountering the truth that being a disciple of Jesus isn't comfortable, it isn't easy, and it isn't safe. I'm always reminded of, there's a scene, C.S. Lewis, the great author who wrote The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and the other Narnia Chronicles. The Christ figure in these books that he wrote is a lion, and the lion's name is Aslan. And Susan, one of the kids who are kind of the heroes of the story, says to the kid's guide in the very first book, when they are first hearing about Aslan, says to their guide, "Oh, I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion." To which her guide responds, "Safe? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good." That's the God that we meet in the wilderness. Not a safe God. A God who wants us to experience weakness and vulnerability, because as the Apostle Paul tells us, it's in our weakness that we're made strong. This whole voluntarily following Jesus into the wilderness, it's what fasting is all about. You may have heard that word. You may have participated in fasting before. Often we think about it as going without food for a period of time, but really we can fast from anything. And it's intricately tied to the season of Lent in Christian tradition. Fasting is about taking something, anything, that's a comfort, that's a distraction, and setting it aside for a time. It's about intentionally making ourselves uncomfortable, weak, and vulnerable in expectation that God shows up in those places and God does good work in us in those places. Sometimes the wilderness is thrust upon us, and sometimes we need to engage in what we call a spiritual discipline of stepping into the wilderness ourselves, and that's what fasting does. Just like our 40 days is meant to mirror Jesus' 40 days, so is our fasting meant to mirror Jesus' fasting in his wilderness. And just like Jesus, here's this warning, just like Jesus was met by temptation when at his weakest, we will also be met by temptation when we have allowed our fasting to weaken us. I don't know what gets in the way of you and God. I don't know what makes life so comfortable that you don't really need to depend on God. I don't know what the thing is that convinces you that, you know what, I've got it all together, I'm okay. But I do know that the moment we intentionally take that thing and we set it over here and we say, for these 40 days and 40 nights, I'm not going to touch this. I do know you will be entering a time where you will feel weak, where you will feel vulnerable. I do know, and I can promise you, you will be stepping into a time when the devil thinks he's got you. The devil thought he had Jesus. He thought, oh, this guy hasn't eaten anything for 40 days and 40 nights. That's a long time. He's been here isolated, alone in the wilderness. No one to talk to but himself and the trees on the rocks. This is the time I'm going to strike. It's the same when we give up something, when we step foot into the wilderness, when we take on fasting from someone. But God also meets us there in profound and powerful ways. God meets us there because we've got no more barriers. When we're weak and we're vulnerable, there's nothing else we can erect between ourselves and God to keep God at an arm's length, to keep God from doing the pruning or the work that needs to happen inside of us. We just lie there and God's like, okay, are you finally tired out enough that I can do work in you? And what are we going to say? We're weak. We're vulnerable. We're exhausted. We've given up this thing that was our buffer, this thing that we depended on. That's kind of what addiction is all about. But addiction can be anything. It can be any of the things that give us a sense of control, that make us think, oh, we've got this all taken care of. In the wilderness, those things are stripped away. And it's just us face to face with God, and we're very aware of our vulnerability. We're very aware of how little we are in the face of God's extraordinary majesty. But our weakness in that place is not permanent. The temptations don't go on and on and on without end. Because we discover that our weakness, it's not just appearing in the wilderness. It's not just appearing in the fasting. It was there all along. We were just covering it up really well. And once it's uncovered, once we come face to face with it, then God can do something about it. Then God can replace it with his strength. The wilderness is the place in which God does the kind of transforming work we desperately need him to do if we're going to be like Jesus, which is what it means to be a Christian, is striving to be like Jesus, allowing God's Spirit to change us to be like Jesus. So to begin a journey through Lent, a journey through the wilderness, however you might define it in your own life, whether it's a place that you've been thrust because of life circumstances or a place that you choose to intentionally step into, I ask you to consider this. What comfort, what distraction do you need to set aside? What do you need to fast from over these weeks? Will you allow the Spirit of God the space needed to do the work that he wants to do in you? Will you willingly give up the stuff that keeps him at a safe distance? It's not going to be easy. Don't answer, oh, sure, I'm all in that. It's a hard thing to do. Jesus, it was like he was 40 days and then the temptations came. Let me tell you, the temptations will be there all along. Stripped of something that usually buffers us from God, it will be uncomfortable. We'll want to quit. Some of us will quit. But God will be there, and God will honor whatever we're able to do, whatever we're able to offer. If you make it one afternoon and that's it, God will honor whatever we can offer. And I can guarantee you this, we are better for the time in the wilderness.